Diplomats, politicians and soldiers need to raise their so-called religious literacy, according to a Dutch philosopher who teaches international troubleshooters. Evert-Jan O'Neill is a consultant to the Christian aid group World Vision. It's now the second biggest non-government agency working in the Muslim world. Evert-Jan O'Neill says 85% of the world's population identifies with a religion, and that matters in high-stakes diplomacy.
The corridors of power, those are quite often secular contexts. So the interesting thing is that a lot of diplomats or people working in multilateral organizations like the United Nations or also the European Union, they often grow up in secular environments, which makes it more difficult for them to actually understand the impact that religious communities have in the world. One of the things, for example, that I would explain to them is that the world is not becoming less religious, but more religious. It's desecularizing. For example, if you would look at the percentage of agnostics in 1970, it was 15%, and now it's 4.5%. When you look at the atheists in the world, it was 10% in 1970, and it's 2% in 2010. It's amazing how these demographic changes bring the faith factor only more to the forefront and actually make it only more important for diplomats wherever they are and with whatever they deal, how important it is for them to understand the religious mindset and the role of religious institutes in today's world.
Yes, why is the world becoming more religious and not less so? It's a very compelling point that you make, and right. It will discomfort some listeners and it will encourage others.
It does. The blunt, short answer is that religious people are usually more effective in multiplying themselves than atheists and agnostics. They're just more hesitant in having big families. So what you simply have is demographic changes. It's not per se that we have less agnostics and atheists in the world. It's just that we have more religious people in the world.
And successful immigrant countries like Australia, the United States, our future is what? More religious because immigrant communities tend to be, at least for the first few generations, much more religious?
Absolutely. That's an intriguing question also for me coming from the Netherlands, that it's maybe so that in a couple of decades we will become more religious again because of demographic changes in Australia and in other European countries, for example.
Now, you're a philosopher, but are you also religious yourself?
Now we get into the definition of being religious. I would say let's distinguish between religion and faith. And then religion would be more institutional. So it's a kind of institutional expression of faith. I'm not so much into religious institutes, but I'm much more into faith. So I do have a faith, and I would identify myself with a particular faith, but not so much in an institutional way. If that makes sense to you?
Indeed it does. Now, as a philosopher who travels the world, meets with international figures, what in your view, Evert, is the most urgent matter of our time?
Ooh, I think as the world is globalizing, understanding each other is absolutely something that is very important. Understanding the mindset and the passions of someone else in the world is becoming more and more important because everything is getting connected. So if things are not in order on the other side of the world, there is a way for this violence or unrest or fear to get into other countries, either through the internet or through trade. But what we face right now is that we have to understand what goes on in other people's minds. And of course, the faith factor is very important in this. I'm also saying this from a Dutch perspective and more widely from a Western perspective. I think fear is one of the most dominant emotions in our Western societies. And fear partly because of a sense that we lose control. For so many decades, the West could control the economy. Before that, we could control even on a political level. But what we see now is loss of control. And rather than trying to understand the new markets and the new powers, we get fearful. We duck and we try to protect ourselves. And that's not the best way to deal with differences in the world.
I think you've also observed that while certain secular countries may score higher on the so-called happiness index, I mean, we might be thinking about the Nordic countries in particular. I mean, Denmark, I think, is supposed to be one of the happiest places in the world. You've also observed, though, that the people can be more isolated and have an increasing lack of resilience. What do you mean?
It's fascinating, yes. If you look at this happiness ranking, which is not just a ranking based on income, it really goes broader than that. It's about health and it's about feeling protected and participating. Yeah, so the most secular countries would really do well in terms of happiness. But what I would say is we in those secular countries ranking very high on happiness, we do very well in being happy for as long as everything is in order. But what I see in the countries ranking that high is that people have more difficulty dealing with setbacks, with adversaries, with things that they can't control. So we're very good at being happy, but we easily get depressed when things are not in control. And even if we face risks that we cannot control, we easily get depressed and we easily get fearful.
In your role with World Vision, you want to draw people's attention to the unique work that faith-based charities can achieve. I mean, what is unique about a faith-based foreign aid in a way that might be different to the United Nations delivering aid?
First of all, I don't want to present World Vision anyway as a kind of organization that does things better than other organizations. United Nations does amazing things and many other secular organizations.
But different.
Yeah, right. So let's say a distinctive feature could be that World Vision, because of its own faith-based background, can spiritually connect with a lot of religious communities in the world, both Christian but also Muslim and Buddhist. And that seems to be an advantage because, as I just said, religion plays such an important role in actually 85% of the world, that if you can connect with religious leaders, with pastors and imams, and you can address these very difficult issues that we face in those communities, exploitation, abuse, discrimination, gender-based violence, you name it. If you can actually also address the spiritual side of that, and sometimes the religious support for those kind of practices, and you can address it in those religious communities, that's really an advantage. Okay. So that's something that, World Vision is exploring and also building on to make sure that we can address also this side of issues in the world.
I can hear, however, the critics say right now, I'll tell you what's different about a faith-based foreign aid organization. They want to give you bread with one hand and a Bible with the other. I can hear that them saying that. I mean, what is the truth there?
Oh, yeah, and it's definitely a trap, and we need to stay away from that, definitely. What World Vision does, we will never change people's beliefs. That's not our call. What we try to do is, for example, when people are infected with HIV, the usual practice in religious communities all over the world, whether Christian or Muslim, is to kick these people out of the church or the mosque, and they can really literally die alone. When we speak with faith leaders, what we try to do is create a safe environment for them to go back to their own holy book, the Bible, the Quran, and we explore with them what actually the Quran and the Bible says about how to treat your neighbor. And of course, both the Bible and the Quran says love your neighbor. And we simply invite these faith leaders to compare what their beliefs say in terms of loving your neighbor with their practices. And, it doesn't seem complicated, and it isn't complicated, but what happens is these people can really break down once they realize that their own values and their own beliefs are not in line with their own actions. And these people can suddenly dramatically change their attitude towards people infected with HIV. And that's what we see. We're not changing their beliefs. We're simply highlighting those elements in their beliefs that can provoke a loving response to people in their communities.
Yes, I was interested to read that World Vision is the second biggest provider of aid and relief in the Muslim world after the Aga Khan Foundation.
Isn't that interesting? And we will not be able to work in those Muslim contexts only with Christian staff. We have a lot of Muslim staff. And so this is really something that we really try to connect with Muslim communities, not only from a Christian point of view, but also really connect with them through our staff, being also Muslim staff.
To what extent, though, Evatt, do you think that is a bit of a challenge to the organizations themselves, because World Vision did come out of an evangelical Christian background? I mean, has that been a challenge to transform that organization itself?
Oh, yes. But we had 60 years. Yeah, we had pretty much an evangelical start. Actually, everything was evangelical about World Vision 60 years ago. We had evangelical staff. We worked through evangelical churches. We were supported by evangelicals. And then an important moment in World Vision's history was when we started to run our own programs. So before that, in the first 30 years, we did things through churches. So we're also bound to working through these particular churches. But then we had our own programs in the last 30 years, and that opened up a whole new range of opportunities. Suddenly we could go to places where there are no Christian churches. And so we suddenly could enter countries like Pakistan and Afghanistan, and we could go to all these places where we would not have been able to go to if we would have only worked with Christian churches. And also we entered countries where the Christians are in a minority, and we started trying to find support from a wide variety of supporters in also secular countries. And so what you could see is gradually we opened up and we broadened ourselves, and we had a wide range of Christians becoming staff, but also other faith staff and secular staff entering our organization. And gradually the whole organization went through a drastic change.
I wonder what role faith-based charities might play in sort of quelling violent extremism. I mean, the obvious one that comes to mind is ISIS. Is there a role for faith-based development in dampening down that kind of extremism, which, of course, grows out of one form of religion, as you know?
Yeah, I think there is, in all modesty, because this is a very complicated issue. But what I think behind extremism, you often see an identity crisis, people not knowing who they are. What you also see is a lack of perspective. I think both being poor without any perspective on having the dignity of work and of a place in society. So faith-based NGOs can connect with both, of course, the poverty reduction, but also on the other hand, the identity issue. Who are you? And without giving the answers, what we could do is help facilitate and encourage religious communities to tackle that identity issue, being really an important part of people deciding, for example, to fight in Syria. And what I see in the Netherlands is that these people are really looking for an identity and for the dignity connected to that identity. And I think there is a spiritual side to that that faith-based organizations can address.
And just finally, what about the effectiveness of aid and development more broadly? Dr. Sam Gregg, who's a director of research at the Acton Institute in the United States, recently spoke at the Center for Independent Studies, and he made this critique.
Many poverty alleviation programs that involve redistribution, like foreign aid, are increasingly discredited. I think it was the economist and historian of the Federal Reserve, Alan Meltzer, as he once put it, one of the 20th century's economic lessons is, quote, that transfers, grants, and redistribution did little to raise living standards in Asia, Latin America, and Africa. In other words, the standard wealth redistribution policies, often regarded as indispensable for poverty alleviation, have largely failed to achieve their goals. I think it behooves all Christians to ask ourselves why such approaches have failed if we're going to have a serious conversation about wealth and poverty in the modern world.
Now, I mean, how do you respond to that? Wow. He's not alone in making that criticism, as you know.
No, and we shouldn't hide and we shouldn't ignore those kind of notions. Very important for us to stay sharp. I think basically behind all this is the sustainability question. So really, who is taking over? Because it's easy to build a road or to plant a hospital somewhere. But where's the sustainability factor? Where are really people empowered and motivated and equipped to move forward on their own and build their own country? And this is something I think this is really an important part of the new development work, that we don't settle for simply building a hospital somewhere, but we really want to connect with the most sustainable communities. And those are often religious communities, and really trying to work through these stable presence of communities in those countries and hopefully make ourselves redundant, and having encouraged and equipped and helped these and supported these religious communities to take over and move forward.
Evert Jan Owenaal is a Dutch philosopher, but he's not spending his time in the ivory tower. He works at the very coalface, very practically. He's an advisor to World Vision International and World Vision Australia. Evert, thank you very much for joining us on the Religion and Ethics Report.
Well, thanks so much.
And you're with Andrew West.